Hi everybody, welcome to the Bereans Bible Institute. I'm Tim Warner, your teacher. We're in module number 11 still, the book of Revelation. We're going verse by verse through the book of Revelation. This is lesson number 27. We have completed our work through the first 11 chapters. We're going to be getting into chapter 12. Chapters 12, 13, and 14 each are their own parenthetical section. And I mentioned before when we were talking about the seven seals and then the seven trumpets that Revelation has these parenthetical sections in them. And the reason why they're there is because they're intended to anticipate certain questions that would naturally arise among the audience, which was the seven assemblies that in Asia Minor. Based on what had been taught so far, that it would instigate certain questions from the framework of these mostly Gentile Christians living in these cities of Asia Minor, where in some cases, or they were either that actual assembly was founded by the Apostle Paul, especially the Ephesus, and then from Ephesus the gospel spread out to these other assemblies. And so they had as their sort of the apostle that had branched out into Asia Minor and brought the gospel to these folks. It was the Apostle Paul. And so they had a lot of oral teaching from the Apostle Paul, as well as his written works, including, of course, the book of Ephesians, which was addressed directly to the very first assembly there in the seven letters, the church of, or assembly of Ephesus. And so Paul had laid the foundation. He had taught in these, especially Ephesus, he had taught in person for lengthy periods of time. And so they had a lot of apostolic oral tradition that went out then from Ephesus to these other assemblies in the general vicinity of Western Asia Minor. So they had this theological background from the Apostle Paul. Well, after Paul was executed in Rome, and then Peter was also executed the very next year in Rome, then shortly after that, the city of Jerusalem was destroyed. John was probably in Jerusalem leading up to the years just prior to it being destroyed. And you may remember that Jesus said in Luke 21, he said to his followers, his disciples, he says, when he predicted the coming destruction of Jerusalem, and he says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, that they are to flee to the mountains and get out of there because of all the persecution and trouble that was going to be coming down and crashing down upon Jerusalem and upon Judea by the Roman armies that were going to be sent by God to destroy Jerusalem and destroy the temple. And so they were warned to flee. And so most likely John was one of those people who was part of the original, he was part of the 12, and so the 12, most of the 12, I should say, the 11, started out as being sort of leadership in the Jerusalem assembly, but, you know, some of them went out in other directions. Some of, we know that a few went east and so forth, but when Jerusalem, when these things happened and the Christians fled the city of Jerusalem, John, either at that time or maybe slightly before, John left Jerusalem and he ended up settling in the city of Ephesus. And he did this shortly after or around the time that Paul was executed in Rome. And so the thing about John's works, all of John's works, John wrote five books, right? The Gospel of John and then 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Epistles of John, and then finally the book of Revelation. John wrote all five of his books with the same kind of underlying mental framework. And what that was to completely reinforce the teachings of Paul. Because Paul, as the apostle to the Gentiles, he was the only one who Jesus specifically said, I'm calling you to go to the Gentiles. And Paul was uniquely qualified for that role. And, God sent him to the Gentiles, and he established these churches, and he taught a lot of things to the Gentiles. Now, we know that by the time Peter and Paul were executed, that all Christian theology, the fundamentals of Christian theology were already firmly established by Peter and Paul, especially Peter and Paul, but also some of the others were working alongside them. And so we see that in the book of Jude. Jude was written shortly after that. And Jude starts out by saying, he wanted to write concerning the common salvation, but that there was an urgent need. And that urgent need was that wicked men have crept in, and they have begun to pollute the teachings of the apostles. And they were doing this within some of the churches. But Jude goes on to say, he says he was writing to encourage the brethren, especially the pastors, to earnestly contend for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. Now, that statement that the faith, the Christian faith, was once for all delivered to the saints, stating this shortly after the destruction of Jerusalem and the execution of Peter and Paul, shows us that the Christian faith had been sort of sealed up as a complete package, if you will. All the fundamental necessary teaching and truths were established by these apostles, okay, that had died. Now, John remained alive after that. And so you might say, well, John, if John wrote his books after that, wasn't he also teaching by revelation from God? Yes, he was teaching by revelation from God, but John was not introducing any new doctrines. Okay, all John did, in fact, there is nothing new from John. Now, there is some clarification, but there's nothing new that had already not been taught orally by the other apostles. What John did was he reminded them of prior teaching. He clarified some things. He brought the Old Testament to bear in order to connect some of the dots. And he didn't do this because Paul's preaching had been, insufficient. It wasn't. Paul's teaching was not insufficient. In fact, some people think, well, yes, John was, he was in a vision. He was caught up into heaven and shown all these things. Yes, but Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 that he had a similar experience, and this was many years before John. So, in fact, in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, let me just read to you the first few verses. He says, "It is doubtless not profitable for me to boast. I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man in Christ," and he's talking about himself, "14 years ago, whether in the body I do not know, or whether out of the body I do not know, God knows. Such a one was caught up to the third heaven." And remember, he said he's talking about visions. So this is a vision. He wasn't actually there. "Such a one was caught up to the third heaven. And I know such a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know, God knows, that he was caught up into paradise and heard inexpressible words, which is not lawful for a man to utter. Of such a one I will boast, yet of myself I will not boast except in my infirmities. For though I might desire to boast, I will not be a fool, for I will speak the truth, I will refrain, lest anyone should think of me above what he sees me to be or hears from me. And lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelation." So it's clear that it was Paul who was seeing these visions. "A thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it might depart from me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I would rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Okay, so the point is that Paul had a similar experience to John. Now, we also know from the book of Galatians that shortly after Paul's conversion, because you know Paul was not one of the 12 originally. And Judas fell away and he killed himself, so that when we get into the beginning of the book of Acts, we've only got 11 apostles. But shortly after that, Christ called Paul to be his apostle to the Gentiles, rounding back the number to 12. And so forth. So, but what we see from Galatians is Paul says that shortly after that occurred on the way to Damascus, and he was in Damascus, and Ananias came, and you know he received this sight again, and so forth. That Paul went into Arabia, and he was alone in Arabia, off in the desert, for quite some time. I believe it was 3 years. And during that period of 3 years, Christ gave him visions and teaching, taught him from heaven by means of his holy breath. Remember, Christ first called Paul from heaven, right, on the road to Damascus. But Christ continued to teach Paul. He got him up to speed with all that he had taught his other disciples, which was also over a 3-year period. But he also gave Paul additional revelation that was going to be necessary for him to complete his mission as the apostle to the Gentiles, specific information that Peter and so forth, you know, since they were focusing on the Jews, that they didn't really need with regard to dealing with the Jews and evangelizing the Jews. But Paul needed some additional revelation. In particular, what he needed was more clarity on the role of the law of Moses versus the new covenant that Jesus inaugurated at the Last Supper, and how these two covenants relate to one another, and how Christians become Abraham's seed and joint heirs of the Abrahamic promises along with Jews. Those kinds of things were essential for Paul's mission to the Gentiles, and so it was because of that Paul then was uniquely qualified. Okay, so now we come to, after Paul's death, and we come to John. Years later, here's John. He moves to Ephesus, and he begins to write his gospel, and he begins to write his epistles, and then finally he writes Revelation. And in every case, all 5 of those books, what he's doing is reinforcing Paul. And so what you can do as you read through John's gospel, his epistles, and in Revelation, as I'm going to demonstrate, what you see is he is developing themes that Paul already taught. Now, you might say, well, I mean, we're going to look at, in particular today, we're going to look at Romans 11, and we're going to look at Galatians 3 and 4 to look at some of Paul's teachings. But it's very clear that John is drawing from these passages from Paul. But you have to also understand that those, you know, what we have recorded in Romans or in Galatians, that is only a small sampling of Paul's teaching, because the vast majority of Paul's teaching was done orally in person, standing there or sitting there in the midst of these assemblies, and like, you know, sitting there for 2 whole years. He did this in Rome for 2 whole years. He sat in his own hired house, we learn in the last chapter of Acts, while he was under Roman guard. And all these, you know, these members of the Roman assembly and some of the Jews from the synagogue would come and interact with Paul. And all he was doing for 2 years was expounding the scriptures, expounding the Old Testament scriptures, and also showing them in light of all this revelation that Christ had given to him while he was in Arabia, and also further revelation that Christ had taught him by means of his holy breath during the earlier parts of his ministry. All right? So John comes along. His main purpose is to head off some of the false teaching that was going on. That was his purpose in John's gospel, but he didn't do it by introducing anything new. And a lot of people think, oh, John brought in new things, like the whole idea of, you know, the preexistence of Christ and, you know, him being the Logos and all that. No, Paul taught that in Hebrews chapter 4. Paul taught the preexistence of Christ in Hebrews chapter 1. Paul taught the preexistence of Christ and him being co-creator or God's agent in creation. He taught that in Colossians chapter 1. He taught Christ that Christ was in the form of God and then became man. He taught that in Philippians chapter 2. All right, so he also taught it in Hebrews. So, you know, these things that John introduced in the first part of his gospel and then throughout his gospel, people think, oh, that's just later new information that wasn't available. No, it was already available. It was already taught. It was taught orally by the Apostle Paul, but then it was also included in some of Paul's epistles. Okay, so we have to understand that John's not bringing anything new to the table in his gospel, his epistles, or in the book of Revelation. What he's doing in Revelation is enlightening first he's reminding the seven assemblies of what Paul taught. He's being shown similar visions of the future, just like Paul had already been shown years ago and had already taught orally to the assemblies back then, including Ephesus and so forth, these ones that Paul, that John is addressing. And also, John drew together many Old Testament passages, but all of this was to support Paul's oral and written teaching. Okay, that's extremely critical. And if you understand that, you'll see that John's gospel and his epistles just flow together, and Revelation. It all flows together into a nice, neat package along with Paul. And as we interpret the book of Revelation, if we understand that John's purpose is to clarify and to remind of what Paul taught, and to just maybe connect some dots, he's not introducing anything new, then that gives us a great deal of insight in how to interpret Revelation. Okay, so that's just a nice little tip there for you as you study the book of Revelation, or as you study any of John's writings. That's something you need to know, because it will throw open difficult passages as you study. And so I wanted to spend some time talking about that. Now let's apply that principle to what we've been talking about, and that is that there are parenthetical sections in Revelation. Why are they parenthetical? Why doesn't he just reveal everything chronologically? Why does he go back and deal with things? The reason is because first he wants to lay out a little chronology, like, for example, the seven seals. But before he closes down that chronology, he wants to anticipate questions that would automatically arise in the minds of these seven assemblies that have Paul's teaching as their fundamental foundation for their system, their faith system, right? The faith once for all delivered to the saints. And so what they would do is they would consider what John is teaching in the book of Revelation, and they would compare that to what Paul had taught in his oral teaching and in his epistles. And then questions would pop into their mind. Well, what Revelation does is it anticipates those questions and it answers them. All right? And this is also an important key to unraveling the book of Revelation. So, let's talk about these two parenthetical sections that we've already gone over. The first one was between the sixth and the seventh seal. Right? So we've got in those seals, we've got God's judgment, because the Lamb is breaking the seven seals. Well, the seven-sealed scroll, if you may remember, was drawn out of an Old Testament parallel, and that was Ezekiel, right? Ezekiel was the guy who was shown a scroll that was written inside and outside, which is very unusual for a scroll. It's usually only written on one side. So when we get to Revelation and we see that this scroll, that the Lamb is going to open the seals, that this scroll is written inside and outside. Well, that's intended to draw a parallel to Ezekiel. And what was Ezekiel's scroll all about? It was all about the judgments that God was going to be bringing upon his own people, Israel. And so we see then that we should look at the seven sealed scrolls and the plagues that come out of that as primarily focused on the promised land, primarily focused on his people Israel and those and that surrounding area, their interaction with the people around them. Because remember, God not only is going to judge his people, but he's also going to judge the surrounding nations that afflict his people. Okay? So during during the tribulation period, the seals deal with the 7-year tribulation from that perspective, like Ezekiel being a prophet to Israel, here John being a prophet. He's not speaking to Israel, but he's telling the Christians how God is going to deal with Israel in the end times, primarily Israel, okay? It's not really dealing with Christians worldwide. And so that's why, you know, at the between the 6th and the 7th seal, all of a sudden John sort of jumps back to the beginning of the tribulation where, you know, he says, but before all these things happen, before you hurt, you know, we've got these plagues coming on the earth, on the land, that is the land of Israel. These plagues are coming on the land in the opening of the seals. But then it says, he sees this, these four angels that are about to, you know, bring God's judgment. That is to actually, employ the wrath of God that's contained in the seals. And he says, hurt not the earth. It said to these seven angels, or these four angels, hurt not the earth or this sea or anything like that until we have sealed the servants of God in their forehead. And then he identifies who those servants of God are. And he says that they then seal 144,000, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. And so we see by putting that there between the 6th and 7th seal, we know that that sealing of the 144,000 is in the context of the whole group of seals, which is all about God's wrath upon his land and upon his people. So a question then would arise, okay, understanding that these seals are related to Ezekiel's role being the prophet to Israel and explaining why God's judgments are coming down on them. Understanding that, these Christians would then say, well, okay, Ezekiel also said, and we ran over this passage because they remember the 144,000 are quoting from Ezekiel 9, right? So he points them back to Ezekiel, not just to the seven sealed scroll, but also now he says, the question that would arise would be, what's going to happen to those Jews that are going to repent in the end times and turn back to Christ? Because Paul taught in Romans 11 that Israel was blinded for a time, but that in the end times they were going to return to God, right? So if God is pouring out all this judgment upon Israel through this with his scroll, just like he did. See, back in Nebuchadnezzar's day, when Ezekiel lived, God poured his judgment out on the vast majority of Israel, but he preserved a remnant, right? And he goes on to say, Jeremiah tells us, you know, God used the parable of the good figs and the bad figs as representing his people at that time. And he said the good figs are the ones that Nebuchadnezzar took off prior to the destruction. And he took them away. God had him do that because to spare them from the judgment that was going to happen upon Jerusalem and Judea when he brought Nebuchadnezzar back the second time and he completely obliterated the place. All right. And so God spared his people by pulling them away into Babylon first the righteous, so they escaped the wrath. And then later there were a few stragglers, you know, that came back after the destruction of the temple. So we had kind of two classes of people that escaped. Some escaped early when there was no danger, and some came out from the fire. Okay. Anyway, and that's an important point too, which we'll talk about later when we get maybe into chapter 12. So Ezekiel being the prophet that's kind of connected with the seven seals, as a parallel to his ministry. So when we get into this parenthetical section between the sixth and the seventh seal, God goes back and he gives John a little message here about how he's going to protect his people, just like he did in Ezekiel's day, right? And so he says, you know, he talks about the 144,000 that are sealed in their forehead. Well, that's referencing right out of Ezekiel chapter 9, where God gave Ezekiel a vision about why he was sparing some of his people. And what was the vision? The vision was that God sent these angels in to destroy his people. And but first, before he did that, he sent one who had an ink horn and an ink pen, and he was to go around throughout all the people of Israel. Of course, he's invisible, but he was to put a mark on their foreheads. And then after the foreheads of the righteous, the foreheads of those who were not involved in all the wickedness and who were mourning and crying about all the wickedness in their midst, right? So they set themselves apart as righteous. And so they were sealed in their forehead. And then after that, he sent the destroying angels in, and they were to slaughter everybody who did not have a mark in their forehead. That is God's seal in their forehead, right? So we have that drawn in Revelation as a 6-7. We have that drawn directly out of Ezekiel 9. And again, it's showing that the seals are parallel to what was going on in Ezekiel's day, okay? And so the question that would arise would be, well, how is God going to spare Israel, that is that portion of Israel that is righteous? And so that's what he does. He answers the question without them even asking it by giving you that little parenthetical section. Now we get to the trumpets. Between the sixth and the seventh trumpet, he further develops this idea about how Israel is going to be spared. Right? And so what does he say? He talks about how he's going to send his two witnesses, his two prophets, and they're going to prophesy in Jerusalem, and how that the temple, he shows him the temple there that's rebuilt, and he shows them the worshipers there. Who are the worshipers that are worshiping before the altar at the temple in Revelation chapter 11 and 12? Well, these are the Jews. These are the 144,000 that were sealed in their forehead, and he's showing them how God is distinguishing between the righteous and the wicked, and the righteous are the ones who are coming to mourn, to repent, to offer sacrifices according to the law of Moses, and are not just ignoring God's law, because God is going to reinstate the law of Moses for that last 7 years. Right? We see that stated plainly in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. All right, so anyway, and in the midst of that is the abomination of desolation, right? And the taking away again of the daily sacrifice. That's all part of what John is going to be revealing here. But how did the Christians in the seven assemblies that had Paul as their original teacher, how did they know about this theology about Israel turning back to God? Because, see, Jerusalem had been utterly destroyed now by this time, and the Jews had been scattered to the farthest parts of the world. But prior to that happening, Paul had given some very specific teaching about the role of Israel versus the Gentiles, and what God was actually doing by sending the gospel to the Gentiles, and how that God was not only opening the way of salvation to the Gentiles, but he was also dealing with Israel under the covenant that he had given them, which was the law of Moses. He was dealing with Israel according to that law. All right, now I want to look at two passages of scripture to show you that both of those parenthetical sections in the seals and then in the trumpets, that they have to do, they are explaining the teaching of Paul, maybe in a little more detail, okay, and how it's going to, what it's going to look like in the end times, adding a few specific details. But it's, again, it's not really Christian doctrine. It's more like Jewish doctrine, okay, but letting the churches in on some of the Jewish doctrine. All right, so let's look at these two passages briefly. Let's go to Romans chapter 11. I want to start in the verse, actually let's just start in verse 1. I say then, has God cast away his people? And that's Israel, because they rejected Christ, right? Certainly not. Okay, now Paul's writing this decades after Christ ascended to heaven. Has God cut off Israel from himself, wiped his hands of Israel, and said, no, I'm gonna send the gospel to the Gentiles, and there'll be my people instead of Israel? And so Paul says that's the wrong conclusion. And remember, he wrote this before the destruction of Jerusalem. So if they knew this from Paul, and now John is talking to them shortly after the destruction of Jerusalem, well, a few decades after, all right, they understand that God has, in fact, dropped the hammer on his people. All right, so here's what he says. I say then, has God cast away his people? Certainly not. For I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew. Or do you not know that the scripture says of Elijah? Now, when he says God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew, he's not saying God, you know, before the foundation of the world, God elected certain Jews to be saved and certain Jews not to be saved. No, that's not what he's saying. He's saying, look, what he's doing is he's saying God has not cast away Israel completely. That is, not all of Israel. There are people in Israel that he has not cast off. And then he talks about himself being a Jew, right, of the tribe of Benjamin. But then when he says God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew, he's taking you back to the Old Testament to show you that in the past, those whom God knew personally, right, they existed. He knew them personally. He had a relationship with them. God did not cast them off. And so in order to prove that point, he talks about Elijah. Elijah was one who had a relationship with God, even though when Elijah prophesied, most of Israel had become apostate, and God cast them off. But he didn't cast off Elijah. Elijah was his prophet to speak to them and, you know, try to encourage them to repent. So he says, God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew. Or do you not know that the scripture says of Elijah, how he pleads with God against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed your prophets and torn down your altars, and I alone am left, and they seek my life. And so Elijah says, yeah, I'm the only one left out of the entire nation of Israel that is faithful to you. And what does God say? But what does the divine response say to him? And again, he begins quoting from 1 Kings chapter 19. What is the divine response to him? Here's the quote. I have reserved for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. All right, so God had a remnant. He knew who they were. He was sealing them so that they would not be destroyed when his judgment came, and so forth. So then he says, so then Paul, by using that example from the Old Testament, he then says, even so then, at this present time, there is a remnant, that is a remnant of Israel, according to the election of grace. Now, who are the remnant of Israel according to the election of grace that Paul was talking about there? He's talking about the Jewish Christians. He's talking about himself as a Jewish believer. He's talking about the other apostles. He's talking about the church or the assembly in Jerusalem, and any of the Jews that happen to be in the Roman assembly. There was a lot of Jews in the Roman assembly at the time, and there were Jews in the assembly in Ephesus and in other places also. So there is a remnant, even though they were by far in the minority of faithful people to God. There still was a remnant of Jews, a remnant of Israel still remained within the Christian assemblies. That was his point. And if by grace, then it is no longer by works, otherwise grace is no longer grace. Now, go down to verse 7. He says, what then? Israel has not obtained, that is the nation as a whole, has not obtained that which it seeks. Well, what does Israel seek? It seeks the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. All right, the land promised permanently, the Messiah reigning, and so forth. But the elect, that is a small portion within Israel, have obtained it, and the rest of Israel, it says, were blinded. Just as it is written, and he begins to quote Isaiah 29:10. God has given them a spirit of stupor, eyes that they should not see, and ears that they should not hear to this very day. And Jesus, I believe, referenced that passage. And then he says, and David says, and then he quotes David in Psalm 69, he says, let their table become a snare and a trap, a stumbling block, and a recompense to them, let their eyes be darkened so that they may not see, and bow down their back always. And so what he's talking about is how, you know, God spares a remnant of his people, Israel, and then he crashes his judgment down on the rest. And he did that in AD 70 when he destroyed the temple and the priesthood. And there was a huge slaughter of Jews, and those who remained were scattered to the far corners of the earth, and many were taken away as captives and slaves. Verse 11, he says, I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall? Certainly not. But through their fall, to provoke them to jealousy, salvation has come to the Gentiles. Now, if their fall is riches for the world, and their failure riches for the Gentiles, how much more their fullness? That is, when Israel is restored. See, Paul teaches the restoration of Israel. And so he says, how much more their fullness? For I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am an apostle to the Gentiles, I magnify my office. If by any means, again, his mission isn't to the Jews, but he explains what God is doing to the Jews. If by any means I may provoke to jealousy those who are my flesh and save some of them. For if they're being cast away, that is the majority of Israel being cast off from God, again, and that was absolutely demonstrated a few years later in the destruction of Jerusalem. For if their being cast away is the reconciling of the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? That is, God's going to bring the nation of Israel back to full repentance. For if the first fruit is holy, the lump is also holy. And if the root is holy, so are the branches. And if some of the branches, and that root is Abraham and his seed. For if, verse 16, for if the first fruit is holy, the lump is also holy. If the root is holy, that is Abraham, so are the branches. And if some of the branches were broken off, that is, some of the seed of Abraham was broken off from the Abrahamic covenant, and you Gentiles, being a wild olive tree, or being from a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them, that is what the remainder of that root that is still attached to Abraham, that is grafted in with the believing Jews. He says, grafted in among them, and with them became a partaker of the root and fatness of the olive tree. Do not boast, you Gentiles. You're in a foreign tree now. Do not boast against the branches, that is the branches that were broken off. But if you do boast, remember that you do not support the root, but the root supports you. But you will say then, well, branches are broken off that I might be grafted in. And so, see, this is a way of the Gentiles sort of elevating and boasting against the Jews who were broken off. Well, look what Paul says to that. He says, well said, because of unbelief they were broken off, and you stand by faith. Do not be haughty, but fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, he may not spare you either. Therefore, consider the goodness and the severity of God on those who fell, severity, but towards you, goodness. If you continue in his goodness, otherwise you also will be cut off. That is, they will not have the inheritance of the Abrahamic covenant. And they also, that is, the unbelieving Jews who have rebelled against God, who crucified Christ and been cut off from Israel, they also, if they do not continue in unbelief, will be grafted in, for God is able to graft them in again. For if you are cut out of an olive tree, which is wild by nature, and grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these who are natural branches be grafted into their own olive tree? Now, when is all this going to happen? Well, it happens at the second coming. There's a lot of Old Testament prophecy that predicts this. For I do not desire, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own opinion, that blindness in part has happened to Israel. For how long? Until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. Now, that's an important statement because Jesus uses almost the exact statement in Luke 21 when he was predicting the destruction of Jerusalem. And when he told Christians, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, you need to flee out of the city because the wrath is coming down on Judea and Jerusalem, and you don't want to be anywhere near it, right? He told them that. But he also said that Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot, that is, this exile that I'm imposing on Israel. They will be trampled underfoot until the times of the Gentiles are completed. And that means the time that God has allotted for the gospel to be open to the Gentiles. But see, that period of time comes to an end. And it comes to an end at the beginning of the tribulation, because look what happens. It says, verse 28, and he says then, and so, that is, after the time of the Gentiles comes to an end, which in Luke 21, it puts it just before the signs of the end times begin, which is the tribulation. All right, so we have the times of the Gentiles being completed at the beginning of the tribulation. That's clear in Luke 21. Well, here as well, he then says, after he says that, referencing what Jesus said in Luke, he then says, and so all Israel will be saved. That is, all 12 tribes of Israel will be saved. It doesn't mean every Jew will be saved. It means all 12 tribes will be saved. And all 12 tribes, a remnant from all 12 tribes will be saved because of God's promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Jacob was the father of the 12 tribes. All right? So he says, as it is written, the deliverer will come out of Zion, and he will turn away ungodliness from Jacob. That's in Isaiah 59, 20, and 21. For this is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. So God is going to wipe the sins off of Israel. He's going to forgive the whole remaining nations. That is, this remnant from each of the 12 tribes, even though now they are God's enemies, as he says in the next verse. Considering the gospel, that is the new covenant and the teaching of the apostles, he says, they are enemies for your sake. They're enemies of God, and they're enemies of Christians. But God is going to restore them, and he's going to put them through the ringer in order to do it. And that's why the seven seals are there, all right, in Revelation. So he says, but the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. I'm sorry, back to verse 28. He says, considering the gospel, they are enemies for your sake, but concerning the election, and that is the election that he spoke about in Deuteronomy, when he was calling the 12 tribes of Israel out of Egypt and bringing them into the promised land. It uses that term, election. He says, but concerning the election, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers, that is for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who begat them. All right, then he says the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. What he's essentially saying is the promises and the things that God promised Israel in the Old Covenant when he called them out of Egypt, and the promises that he made to the patriarchs regarding their sons, that these are irrevocable. God's not going to just ignore them because Israel ignored him. God is going to fulfill the promises, even though he has to do it with a small remnant from each tribe. You know, he did the same thing when he wiped out a whole generation of Israel and only allowed their children to go into the promised land. He kept some from all 12 tribes. So he kept 12 tribes, but they were much smaller when they went into the promised land than they were when they came out of Egypt, right? Well, the same thing is going to happen in the end times, all right? So then he says, verse 30, he says, "For you were once disobedient to God, yet you have now obtained mercy through their disobedience. Even so, these also have now been disobedient, that through the mercy shown shown you, they also may obtain mercy." So they're going to obtain mercy. And this is what the seven-year tribulation is all about. It's all about God providing mercy for the nation of Israel so that he can reconcile them back according to the covenant that they're still under. They're still under the law of Moses. Okay? They're under the curse of the law. Paul says that plainly in Galatians 3. All right. And so forth. All right, so I'm going to stop there. Now let's flip over to Galatians chapter 3. And in Galatians 3 and 4, Paul, the purpose of Galatians was to show Gentiles why they are not under the law and they should not be concerned about keeping the law because that was Israel's covenant. And not only was it a national covenant with the nation of Israel, but also even Christians who, those Jews who become part of Christ by trusting Christ, being baptized into the new covenant, that those Jews now also escape what God is doing with Israel as a nation, because God has to treat Israel collectively according to the collective terms that he gave in the law of Moses. See, they agreed to certain terms in the law of Moses. They agreed to obey God's law, and if they obeyed God's law, he was going to bring all these blessings on them. But if they disobeyed God's law, he was going to bring all these curses upon them, including driving them out of the land and sending them into the land of their enemies and being slaves and being persecuted everywhere they went. Well, they're still being persecuted everywhere they went, and Jerusalem is still, the temple is still destroyed and desolate, which tells us that Israel is still in the exile that God predicted under the second exile that God predicted under the law of Moses. And then in the prophets, he said that he was, after the first exile, he was going to give them another exile. Okay, but all of this has to do with the terms they agreed to in the law of Moses. So Israel is in exile. But, and that's part of the law, which means Israel is under the law. However, in the same passages where God is making all these threats, Deuteronomy 28, 29, and 30, he then says in chapter 30, he gives them the terms whereby he will release them, whereby he will bring them back from their captivity and from being scattered and from all the plagues that he's put upon them. He will bring them back to the land and he will fulfill the promises that he made of the permanent inheritance to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All right, so he gives them the terms. And what are the terms? The terms are, you must repent according to the law of Moses. Those are the terms. Israel is still under the law. Israel is in exile because they have rebelled and they have turned against Christ, God's son. And so God drove them out of the land. And there are a few Jews still in Israel, but they are there and they're not living according to the blessings that God said he would give them if they were faithful. And so God has to, now because of the circumstances after driving them out, God has to be the one to orchestrate the events so that they have the opportunity to do what Deuteronomy 30 says, which is to keep the law of Moses. Well, how can they keep the law of Moses if they don't have a temple? Because the whole thing surrounds the temple and the priesthood and all the regulations that go along with it, including coming up to Jerusalem to keep the festivals, offering the sacrifices, all that stuff is part of the law of Moses. So how is he going to do that? Well, that's what Daniel 9:27 says, is that he's going to give them a little window of opportunity. It's 7 years long. And that window of opportunity is he is going to strengthen the covenant. That is the law of Moses. He's going to strengthen it. How's he going to strengthen it? Well, if the temple's destroyed and the priesthood is destroyed, he's going to strengthen it by bringing back the temple and bringing back a priesthood. And the reason, and the only way he can bring back a priesthood is by a prophet, by prophets. Okay, prophets have to anoint the priesthood. But also we know from the end of the first exile that once the temple was to be rebuilt, God brought two prophets. Right? Two prophets to bring that about, to encourage the people to build and to protect them while they build. And so this is going to be repeated again in the first half of the tribulation. And that's why we see then the worship in the temple, and of these 144,000 coming to worship. That's what they're doing by worshiping in the temple, is they are fulfilling the terms of Deuteronomy 30. That's part of the law. Also remember, the Old Testament ends with a very important statement to Israel. Remember, they reject the New Testament, so the book of Malachi is their revelation, if you will. All right, because they don't accept the New Testament. So how does their revelation end? It talks about the day coming that's burning like an oven, where all the proud and the wicked are going to be burned up. But that God, what does it say there? It says that, but to you who fear my name, that is, this small remnant of Israel who do fear my name, he says that the Son of Righteousness will arise with healing in his wings. And then he says, you are going to go out like stall-fed calves and trample on the ashes of the wicked. But when he's talking about this remnant, he says that, you know, God is observing them. And he says, a book of remembrance. He talks about those who weep and mourn over Israel, just like in Ezekiel 9. He's talking to the 144,000 in Malachi, the end of Malachi 3 and the beginning of and all of 4. He's talking to the 144,000 Jews, and he says that God is a book of remembrance that's before him. And he's recording the names of all those who are mourning and are meditating upon his name. That these are the ones who are repenting, and the ones who are then going to worship at the temple under the influence of the two prophets, right? And so he's going to spare them. Well, see, this is what these questions in these parenthetical sections are about. Now, I'm actually out of time, so I don't have time to go through Galatians 3 and 4, but I do need to go through Galatians 3 and 4 with you, because the Galatians 3 and 4 ties this in with the next logical question. After we go through the seals and we go through the trumpets, what's the next logical question after God answers the question about, you know, what's going to happen to Israel? What's going to happen to those that Paul said are, you know, that are enemies of the gospel now, but they're going to return to God in the end time so that God can fulfill his promises to the patriarchs? So, okay, that's the 144,000. But what's the next question that comes to mind when we look at all the plagues that God is sending upon the earth? Well, the question that would come to mind to these seven assemblies is, well, what's going to happen to us when the poo hits the fan? Right? What's going to happen to us? And so chapter 12 answers that question. All right? Chapter 12 answers that question. And so we will we'll look at chapter 12. We'll actually look at Galatians 2 and 3, because Galatians 2 and 3 provide Paul's theological teaching, where he's comparing the Jews under the old covenant to Christians who are baptized into Christ and then become Abraham's seed, right? The ones who are going to inherit the promises that God originally gave to Abraham and his seed, right? So anyway, he draws a parallel between these two groups. And he especially, in chapter 4, which we'll talk about those two chapters next time, but he especially then, he lays out an allegory in chapter 4. And that allegory that Paul laid out in chapter 4 forms the foundation for what John then reveals or shows us through his vision in Revelation chapter 12. All right, and it has to do with what is, how are God's faithful people of the assemblies? So he's already told us how those of Israel that God is going to spare, what's going to happen to them, and how God is going to put a mark on them, and he's going to withhold judgment upon them. He's going to spare them because of the mark, that the seal that he puts on their forehead. But what's going to happen to the Christians of the assemblies who have been baptized into Christ and have become Abraham's seed? What's going to happen to them? Okay, so stay tuned for the next lesson, because it's really, really critical. Because, you know, as us as Christians, as we're looking through the book of Revelation, really what we want to know is not so much what's God going to do with Israel. What we want to know is, what about us, right? What's going to happen to us? How are we going to survive the end times? We don't have, you know, we're not part of the 144,000 that are going to be spared. So what's going to happen to us? Well, again, chapter 12 answers the question, but it only answers the question by going back and borrowing from Paul's allegory in Galatians. Well, all his teaching in 3 and 4, but the allegory that's in Galatians 4 kind of wraps it all up. All right, so what we'll do next week is we will lay the foundation from Galatians, and then we're going to get right into Revelation chapter 12. All right, so this lesson was pretty much just an introduction, especially regarding those parenthetical sections and why they're there. And you know, as we proceed, you'll see even in the later parenthetical sections that John is reinforcing Paul's teaching. All right, like chapter 13 talks about the beast arising out of the sea and the temple being defiled with the image and all that stuff. All that's doing is explaining 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, where Paul taught about the abomination of desolation in the temple. Of course, Paul was borrowing from Jesus, but Paul's the guy who taught it to the Gentiles, and so, you know, John again begins to reinforce what Paul taught about the Antichrist. And then when we get farther down into chapter 14, we'll also see that John is now reinforcing Paul's teaching again. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, all right? So we'll get into that later. But for now, that's it for today. I've gone a little bit over time. One final thing I want to say for those who are following every week as I'm putting up, or each time that I'm putting up these videos, you're sort of waiting there with bated breath until I put up the next video. That's tongue-in-cheek. But anyway, for those of you, I made an announcement on the website a little while ago, but I don't think it's still there. But I basically said that doing it every single week was really a little much for me, because I'm pastoring the local assembly here in Hickory Tavern, South Carolina. And I'm also doing a lot of research for some more stuff that I'm going to be teaching, and also some articles that I'm writing. And also, I really need more time to work on the Last Generation Version translation. I'm about halfway through the New Testament, maybe a little more. But I need time to get that done. I feel like I'm falling behind on that. So the bottom line is, I'm going to be putting out 2 BBI lessons a month from now on, instead of 4. Okay, so I'll try to get one up, right after the first, and then another one up right after the middle of the month. So don't expect to see a new one every single week. Okay. Anyway, God bless you all, and I've really enjoyed this time of teaching, and I hope you have enjoyed it. I hope it's been informative for you. Anyway, we'll see you next time.